go suck a fat one.
I have an addiction to smut. I'm right-handed, but my ball sack is left-sided. Get the B-Man a double cheeseburger. Take the tip and shut up. Hello, Internet, and welcome to episode 99 of Verbal Graffiti with your host, Brian Glass, a.k.a. the B-Man, the People's Degenerate. 99, got to give some love to the player who wears that number, Aaron Judge, a center fielder, right fielder for the New York Yankees, two-time American League MVP, should be three. And let's move on. A rookie of the year. And let's also move on from that missed easy pop-up in center field during game five of this past year's World Series against the LA Dodgers. We will be able to move on once Aaron Judge and the New York Yankees end this World Series drought that they're in, winning World Series, that is. I actually don't own a baseball card of Aaron Judge. I really do need to get one of those. I don't want an expensive one, just a very colorful one that I could put on my desk behind the camera there. If I ever do get one, I promise to show all of you here at Verbal Graffiti. I did notice episode 98 while editing that my fly was down that entire episode. Comedy 101. Make sure your fly is up before you get on stage to perform stand-up. I'm still, that's why I'm not famous. Because I don't remember to pull my fly up every time before I get on stage to perform. That is why I am a no-name comic. I am becoming a forgetful person, to be, man, I am. This past weekend, or 2 weekends ago, actually, I was at Atticus, which is a lovely, lovely coffee shop, coffee cafe, bookstore in downtown New Haven. I was there Saturday morning, 11:30, and I go in, I get my coffee, large, hot, black, fill it to the top, gave a dollar tip because I'm not a cheap fuck, and I sit down, I'm there by myself because I am a loner, and, you know, the middle of the store is, you know, the baristas, that's their station, they're pouring drinks, they're making sandwiches, and then on one side, there's wooden seats, on the other side, there's wooden seats, there's two doors, and beyond the door is the Yale Art Gallery, and it's all, the door to Atticus is all glass, so you get a nice view of the Yale Art Gallery, and they have that gothic stone structure. It's very scenic. And on the other side of the wall, in the back of Atticus, is the library. Just an entire wall of books that you can buy and read. And I don't really read books that much anymore. So I go into my back pocket to pull out my phone, to pull the B-Man. I'm pulling out my phone because I don't want to, you know, what am I going to do? Just drink the coffee and stare at people? And I realized I forgot my phone. And in that moment, I'm not sure if it's a panic attack or an anxiety attack. It probably was neither of those, but it was on the cusp of having a panic attack and realizing I didn't have my phone on me. So I was in that moment where I was like, okay, do I go to my car and risk losing my seat? Because it was crowded. It was a Saturday morning, so that's peak coffee cafe time. So I'm like, well, I have a good seat. I have a good view at the Yale Art Gallery. There's some people around me. And I'm like, I'm just going to stay here. Stay in the moment. I remember a Ernest Hemingway quote, the loser that I am. I remember this quote from one of his poems where he talked about, or he wrote saying, just observe the people around you. Like, just observe people and the environment. And each time you're in the same environment, you'll notice something different. So it took me 15 minutes, I think, because I didn't have my phone on me to check the time, to get past this cusp of panic attack and just get into that zone. Okay, let me just observe the cafe, the people that are in it, that are coming in and out, and the service workers, and the entire, the smells, the aroma, the sounds, the conversation. I was taking it all in, and I noticed to my right, again, I have a two-person table by myself, to my right, there was this couple, There were clearly a couple sitting across from each other, so the table acted as a cock block. Clearly not a first date. They were together, had that energy. They had been together a while, but not too a while. Like, they were still into each other. And this babe, and she is a babe, like, she was attractive, or is attractive, but she was such a basic Starbucks latte, it's a basic bitch. Everything about it. I was surprised she was not at Starbucks and at this actually a local cafe. But she had just the basic outfit of a young 20-something in America today. She had the grandma or the mother jeans with the thick stonewashed denim, with the, you know, the high waist, but the loose around the legs and ankles. And she had a crop top on that was black, showing her shoulders. She had the almond shaped nails. Yes, I do know what almond shaped nails look like, because maybe I am a bit of a metrosexual, that I do know that. But she had those nails, and she had her boyfriend, who looked like Seth from the OC, if you remember that show. He kind of had that haircut. He kind of was he was nerdy, but he clearly does not live in the OC, and he's not fucking Summer, but he is fucking this babe. So he did have that Seth from the OC look, but he didn't really have the vibe. Like, he didn't have the suave Seth nerdy cool. It was just nerd. Guy, straight up science nerd. Wondered how the fuck those two ever got together. But this babe, she was a repellent for me. I almost wanted to get up and go to the other side of the server station to be blocked from this lady. Conversation, I did not mind. Just her entire look was so basic, so bland. And she had her Seth from the OC looking boyfriend taking photos of her while they were eating their meal or sipping whatever coffee drink they had. And then, so he would take the photos, and then he would hold the phone out, and she would lean over and look at the photos and tell him which ones to keep and which ones to toss in the deletion, wherever the fuck those photos go when you delete on your phone. And I was watching this interaction, and I was... I had a lot of emotions because I was still dealing with my cusp of panic anxiety attack from not having my phone on me and just realizing, you know, this bland almond-shaped nail lady was kind of blocking the view of the beautiful Yale Art Gallery across the street. It didn't ruin my coffee sipping experience, but it was like, I'm going to talk about her in verbal graffiti. And also on the left side of me, there was a table of about like two or three tables that they pushed together, 6-8 people, Yale students, probably freshmen and sophomores. They were definitely the young, they weren't juniors. They were definitely the young. So they had to be freshmen, sophomores. They looked at, I don't know why, I'm getting very perverted. Like, no, they were just Yale students, and I was watching them. Very basic conversation. They all played on the same sports team because they had, not sure what sport it was, but they all had their Yale jackets on. And I noticed they all had huge water bottles. I don't know, like metal, whatever brand. They all different brands, but they had at least be 24-ounce water bottles. And I'm looking at these water bottles. They all had them. They all eight of them had a backpack, and then their water. They had the meal that they bought, the sandwiches, their coffee drinks, and then they had the water bottles that they brought in. And I was looking at those water bottles. And in that moment, I realized that America, we might be defeated, right? China, Russia, ISIS, whatever entity or nation is going to come destroy America and take away our freedoms, they may do so, but it's not going to be because of dehydration. Like, that's one thing you got to give us and all the younger generations is that our younger people, whatever group that the X, Y, whatever, millennials, whatever the fuck they are, like, they will not be dehydrated, right? We might go down and be defeated, but it's not going to be because of dehydration. Like, we will always be hydrated. We will always have 24 ounces of water right on our waist, right on our hip. You might kill us to death. You might drop a drone, a nuke, or fucking orange, Agent Orange, whatever the fuck it is. Like, you might kill us all, but you're not going to it's not going to be because of dehydration. That's the one thing I took away from these Yale students. And, you know, anybody under the age of 30, they got like a gallon of water, and they're hydrated. They are hydrated. So, and the coffee at Atticus, lovely. I suggest you go get some. All right, let's get into something I found on Reddit. Comes from the subreddit customer service. We've all dealt with them. This is below me. I'm not typically one who thinks things are below them. But customer service is way below me, capital letters. I'm not helping you because you're too stupid or lazy to figure it out. Need a password reset? Click the reset button. Need a new debit card? Click order debit card. Need a bank statement? Click on statements. I'm not getting your refill. I'm not answering the question why. I'm not pretending to give a fuck or feel bad about you or your minor inconvenience. There is very little customer service agents can do that the client base cannot. You have all the tools, fucking use them and stop wasting my time with your superficial bullshit and fake problems. And if you can't fucking figure it out, then oh, fucking well. My apologies. I should have told you there might be some curse words in that post. So apologies for not forewarning you for that. I don't believe you. Not one bit. I think you do think people and things are below you. Many people and many things are below you. I think you actually think you're atop everybody and that used to be the king and, the queen of America, if there ever was one. You are a very judgmental person, and that's coming from the B-man, who might be the most judgmental person of us all. This confirms a theory that I've had for a while. I call it the Google theory. We've all had this situation where you'll ask somebody you'll ask them a question, a friend of yours, and then their response is, I don't know, man, Google it. And that response, Google it, that is a veiled way of saying, go fuck yourself. That's basically what Google it means. It's just, dude, I don't have time to deal with your bullshit. Go figure it out yourself on Google. Stop fucking with my time. You're just Googling everybody. I'm glad I have not encountered your customer service, wherever it is you're working. But the funny thing is, I'm so hypocritical because if I worked in customer service, and I have in the past, my mind is, like, we're on the same wavelength because I think the same way as you do with your working customer service. Because if I worked at, let's say I worked at Stop and Shop, a grocery store here in the Northeast America, and like, I was one of the guys up front, and there's a self-checkout line, and, you know, everyone's going through easy peasy with their groceries. And then some old bag can't figure out how to use the self-checkout. So she presses the help button and then ring, ring, ring. Yeah, you bet your ass. Like, as a worker at Stop and Shop, a customer service, I'd be coming to that lady, that old bag who does not know how to use self-checkout. And I'd be bringing attitude with me. I'd look at her. Right. And I wouldn't say it because I need the money, so I need to stay employed. But in my mind, I would be thinking, like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, you just saw 15 people in front of you in line easily use a self-checkout. Easily. This works for everybody. Have you not been to a grocery store the last 20 years? Have you not bought food the last decade? Everywhere you go, they have self-checkout. How is it possible that your old bag don't know how to use the scan? Scan. Do you know the little zip code, the little barcode thing? Scan it. That's all you scan. Scan, scan, stick in your credit card, get your receipt, and go the fuck home. How the fuck can you not know how to do this? Why are you in this self-checkout lane if you know that you don't know how to use the self-checkout? Why don't you just go to the one lane we have with a checkout lady for all the people like you that were born with fetal alcohol syndrome? So go to the 12 and under checkout line and let all of us adults with an actual IQ check out our own groceries. Now that's how I think. Like, I think just like you. But again, I do not work in customer service. The thing is, the way you're complaining about your job at customer service and all these people, patrons who are coming to you with their questions and how you're just, you know, fuck off. Like, how can you figure this out on yourself? That is the right mindset. Everything you're saying, above board. It's 100. You're in the right. 100 out of 100 times, of course, you know, assuming, you know, this is not a mentally disabled person, but just like normal is the wrong words, but you know, just normal, non-mental handicapped person. Like, yeah, figure it out yourself. Google it. You are right. But you are not in the right to complain because you are a customer service employee, and you need to understand that you are at the bottom of the economy. Like, at the very bottom of the U.S. economy is you, and then every job that's been outsourced by the major corporations. So it's you and the guys and gals from India and Latin America who speak broken English that we can't understand over the phone. Like, that's where you are. So, like, that you don't, that you deserve to be there. Like, if you had any skills, you wouldn't be having to work customer service. But you don't have any skills. You probably fucked up like I did. Like, I went to college. I got a degree in political science. What the fuck are you going to do with that degree? Nothing. Like, clearly not qualified for the FBI, not smart enough to be a lawyer, and not savvy enough to be a politician. So I tried to become a stand-up comedian, and look at me now. I am a complete failure in that industry. So I, like, literally, the job I have right now, like, in the real world, is no skills. I copy-paste. I work in an assembly line. I take data from, like, other websites, and I put it on our company's website. And it's like, one case, boom, and then I do it. I just do that all day long, no skills. If I were ever to get fired, I'd be working with you at customer service. So you... like, I understand where you're at, and I'm lucky to be beyond that, but, like, you deserve to be where you're at because you haven't learned any skills to get beyond, like, to climb the ladder. Ladder, what is it? Chaos is a ladder? Whatever the fuck. Like, you need to get beyond customer service, so you need to learn some skills so you don't have to deal with these bullshit questions from these lollipops who are just, like, walking into walls and, like, can't understand the most basic directions or tasks that you need to get throughout the day. You know, this reminds me of that, is it the Spider-Man meme? The one where, like, all the Spider-Mans are pointing at each other? Where it's like, no, I think I'm not the problem, you're the problem. But we're both the same person. When you call customer service or interact at an actual store with a customer service representative, like, as a patron, like, I've been frustrated and angry with the stupidity of the customer service on the phone, but I really don't have a right to be upset with the customer service rep because, like, I know that customer service rep is at the very bottom of our economy. So how can I call customer service expecting to get an answer from the customer service agent when I know the customer service agent is at the bottom, is the least paid person at that company? Like, when you really think about it, like, it's insanity to think that we could call customer service and get an answer when we know they're probably making whatever the minimum wage is, wherever the fuck they're employed at. And then the customer service agent is like, you really don't know how to reset your phone? Like, why don't you just press the button, hold it for 10 seconds, have some patience, right? And if it doesn't start, if you can't figure out, right? Let's say we work at T-Mobile. If I was a customer service agent, I just, my blood would boil. I'd be like, let me see your old phone, all right? It doesn't turn on. Hold the button on the side. Hold it for 10 seconds. And can you have enough patience for 10 seconds? If you don't, I would just take that phone and throw it against the wall. You're not smart enough that own a smartphone. I am going to give you a T-Mobile Sidekick. And once you learn how to operate that, maybe we'll give you a razor. But again, we're all just, it's Spider-Man. We're like, why aren't you helping me? You're the customer service agent. And the customer service agent's looking at you like, how the fuck can you not know how to use your phone? Hold the button. There's one button on the side. Hold it. And we were going back and forth. And just, we're all like, but we're all at fault for thinking we're going to get answers or thinking we have the answers. Customer service agents hate being customer service agents, and all of us on the other side hate having to deal with customer service. It's a hate salad. It's a hate fuck fest without the fucking. So, like, I feel you. And I've been there, but you need to learn some skills and get where your mind is at. Your mind is like post customer service. You just need to get the skills with the mind where your mind is at. Feel me? Let's go look at some photos. Episode 99, segment 2. Episode 100 is right on our ass. It's coming in hot, coming in real quick. We will go over the metrics of this project, Verbal Graffiti, in the upcoming episode, but that is for 100. We are still on 99. We are still on Aaron Judge. Aaron Judge needs to, in my baseball estimation, he needs 3 more highly productive seasons, top of the league, near MVP, not necessarily MVP winning, but MVP type seasons to be a lock first ballot Hall of Famer. He did get a bit of a late start. I think he started his first full year, might have been 25 or 26. Hey, if you look at most Hall of Famers, their first full year is usually in their early 20s. But again, this isn't a baseball podcast, which I keep telling myself. I had a funny thing happen to me last night. You know, I am middle-aged, and last night is when I learned that I do not know how to partake in a conversation if that conversation involves more than 2 other people. So if there are 4 plus people in this conversation, including myself, I do not know how to involve myself in what is being said and or talked about. I realized this. I was outside. I was doing stand-up. We had a gig, and we're outside. And there might have been, let's see, there was 1, 2. There were probably about 5 of us, maybe 6 of us. And it was freezing. It was 25 degrees. They were smoking cigs. I don't smoke. So I was inhaling this secondhand smoke. So I'm probably going to die of lung cancer in my early 60s. And I got to confess, I was going to do dry January. I had a Guinness. You know, my buddy, I said, hey, do you want a Guinness? And how am I going to turn down a Guinness? How am I going to do that? So I caved. I had a Guinness. But I like to drink. So why would I go an entire month without drinking? That is the stupidest thing I would ever do. I might die this month. So I got to drink while the drinking is still there to be had, while I can still have a throat to chug it down. But it was a lovely drink. Again, only had one because I had to drive home. So anyway, we're outside. There are probably, five or six of us. And just comics, bullshitting, chopping it up. 25 degrees. And we're just like in a semicircle, and they're talking about cartoons and referencing movies, and I really didn't like, I was observing, like, I was in the conversation, but I was not a participant in that conversation, if that makes any sense. Like, I didn't say anything. We were outside maybe 25 minutes, and I was not prepared. I did not have my winter hat on, and I have very sensitive ears. So when the weather is cold, my ears get very painful, and my nose runs, and I was a cold mess out there. And I was getting very in my head because it was a very successful conversation for everyone else involved but myself. It took me about 10 minutes into the conversation to realize that I had not said a word to anybody. But it was the conversation was very hacky sack-like. It was just bouncing from one person to the next. It was very fluid. Nobody was dominating the conversation. But the movie references and the sketches that were being talked about, and again, we're all comedy nerds, so... but I'm not a sketch comedy guy, and I'm not a movie buff, so I didn't really have anything to add to the conversation. So I didn't say anything, but I did a lot of fake laughing or fake smiling when everyone else was, because I didn't want to be an outsider and have them all look at me and go, like, why aren't you laughing? Like, this is funny. So, but I didn't. And I got 10 minutes. I was really in my head. I'm like, wow, I haven't said anything. And then it hit me. It's like, oh, I don't know. Now, like, I'm very good one-on-one or by myself, or if there are three of us. Like, I'm good with one-on-one or three-person conversation. I can hold my own. I can leave that engagement feeling I fulfilled my duty in that interaction. But this interaction I had last night, and 40 years, it finally hit me. It's like, oh, if there's more than two other people, like, I do not know how to handle that. Like, I was just standing there. And I became an observer of the conversation instead of a participant. Like, I was observing the conversation that was being had. And I found myself amazed at how fluid this conversation was. It's like a hacky sack. Like I said, it's just someone would make a comment, and then Dan would make a comment, and then Trevor would comment on the comment that was said, and it was just bouncing, and there were no awkward pauses. Like, no one had to look down at their feet, and I was just like looking at the four or five other guys, and we were all guys out there, and I was like, how are they doing this? Like, this is amazing. This should be the local news station, like Channel 8 News, should be here recording this and have it at the 11 p.m. news. It should be the top of Reddit, on the top of Reddit page. Like five guys know how to talk to each other. How, like 40 years, I have not learned how to do this. And it got to the point. So 10 minutes, hadn't spoken. I probably spent another 10 minutes just in amazement of how all these guys were talking to each other without any awkwardness between them. And then there was another, like, the last 10 minutes is where I really got into my head. I'm like, well, I want to leave because I don't have a winter hat on. It's freezing. I'm not, like, I have nothing to add to what is being said and to the laughter that's being, what they're laughing about. But, like, I didn't... It's like that old Dane Cook bit where it's like, well, I don't want to be the first one to leave, because once I leave, like, I was worried that they were all going to be like, well, what was wrong with the B-man? Like, he didn't say a word for 25 minutes. Like, does he not like us? Or how come he only had one drink? Or how come he never smoked cigarettes? So I didn't want them to talk shit about me. So I stayed there for like another 5 minutes. And then, like, I had to tap out. I was like, dude, I gotta go. It's 25 degrees. And then Dan had finished his cigarettes. Like, I'm going to go get another drink. And then Trevor's like, yeah, I got to go too. So thankfully, the conversation dispersed once I, you know, announced that I had to go or wanted to go. And on the drive home, I was just like, how do people do that? Like, how? Maybe that's why I'm not good at parties, because parties usually involve more than three people, including yourself. So, yeah, dinner parties, like, that is a skill maybe I need to work on this upcoming decade. But, yeah, that's wild. Huh? Conversations. Need to learn how to do those. All right. I found this last one on the subreddit family. I have one of those. Not wanting my family to go on vacation around the time I may have brain surgery. So I'm upset because I'm looking into having brain surgery next month. But I found out that my family is planning a trip to another state around the same time. Mind you, I was never invited, nor did they tell me they were going. I confronted them and told them I was upset, but they are still continuing to plan the vacation. I feel extremely unheard and unsupported. Any suggestions on what I need to do? How to react, feel, support groups, question marks? Obviously, I still need as much support as I can get through the surgery and recovery. There's a reason why you don't have a boyfriend to support you post brain surgery, and that's because you're a twat. All right, your personality is a black hole. You are the remnants of a hot dog that was cooked inside a microwave that's still stuck on the walls and the door of the microwave. You're a Debbie Downer, a wet blanket. You are the definition of all those. First of all, who plans a brain surgery? Right? This isn't brain surgery. This ain't getting a new pair of tits, right? Brain surgery is life or death. You don't plan a brain surgery months in advance. You're coherent enough to complain about your family via Reddit on the internet. So clearly your brain is functioning enough where maybe you can postpone your surgery till after the family vacation. But your family, like, all I need to know that you're a twat is that, like, your family is going on a vacation to another state and they won't, like, stop that. Like, that's how I know your family, like, it's not that you're a terrible person. You're just a person nobody wants to be around. And it has nothing to do with your brain. It's all about your personality. Your personality is what you need to do surgery on. It's not, well, maybe it is your brain, but after you get your brain fixed, fix your personality. Because, all right, so if this was an international vacation and your family was like, yeah, we don't give a fuck, we're still going, I understand that because, well, they probably put down a down payment, or if this was an all-inclusive resort, that they're financially, like, in the hole, they're pot committed, that's why they go. But the fact that they're just going to another state tells me that you're probably driving to wherever the vacation is. Maybe it's a state park. Chances are they're not financially handcuffed to that vacation. They probably haven't paid yet for the Airbnb or the RV or whatever passes they need to get into state parks or wherever it is they're going. And the fact that they're not financially invested yet and they're still going to go on the vacation, that's an indictment on you and your fucked up brain. Like, I hate to break it to your sister, but while your family is on this vacation, they're going to be talking shit about you the entire time. They're going to have your parents, your sisters, your brothers, your cousins, they're going to have inside jokes about you at your expense while they're hiking Yosemite State Park. They're going to be joking that, oh, they hope the surgeon's hand slips so that you end up in a coma the rest of your life, because you'd be more enjoyable as a vegetable than the person you are today. Right? You got to understand, like, they planned this vacation without telling you. They're pulling a Home Alone on purpose. And then you told them, hey, I'm getting brain surgery. And then your family's like, yeah, we don't give a fuck. We're still going. At some point, you need to evaluate yourself. Right? 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 Like, I know a lot of us, like, I love my family, but I know a lot of people who they don't like their family. They have no relationship with their family. But once you hear the term brain surgery, most family members are going to listen. I mean, all right, well, at least pretend to be concerned. But your parents and your sisters and brothers not even pretending to care about your well-being and your health and whatever's going on in your brain tells me, like, everything, you've been such a downer your entire life. You're such a twat. You're such a drain on all their energy that it really, that you're so far beyond any support that they could give you. They're like, there's nothing for else. They can't even put the facade of supporting you because you're such, like, every, I know who you are. Like, you have never let anybody in your family enjoy the simplest task, right? Your dad, let's say your dad is eating red meat. You're the daughter who on your phone, you'll show a bunch of cows being slaughtered and ask you, how can you eat that steak? How can you eat that beef? Look at what they do to these cows. They lock them up in cages. They slaughter them. And your dad, I just worked 12 hours at the factory. I did overtime so I could get you your Converse sneakers. Can I eat my beef in peace and quiet? And then, you know, every time you just show them that. And then your mom, you bitch to your mom because she's not working and she's raising two kids. She's a stay-at-home mom. So you think she's a traitor to the feminist movement. And you're always complaining to your mom. How can you allow your dad, how can you let your husband talk to you like that? And then your brothers and your sisters, like, your brother has a birthday party. And of course, he gets the inflatable, like, jumpy room. But it's got to be pink because he can't be blue, because it's got to involve you two, because the world revolves around you and your scrambled brain that needs surgery on. So every year your brother had to have a pink inflatable for his birthday instead of having a blue one or a dragon. It's got to be a pink cake that all his friends jump in, and now he's still made fun of today because of your neediness as a child. That you had this coming to you. This is not an out of the blue, like, oh, brain surgery? Yeah, we're still crossing state lines. This has been brewing since you started to have a personality at 3.5 years old. And all I can really say is, this is all on you. Be more concerned about the surgeon than your family or a support group, because the surgeon, that's what you need. You need a surgeon. And you need to check your personality. And do those two things, and then maybe next year you'll be invited, all right, to Seattle or wherever the hell your family's going on vacation. Do a little self-reflection when you get your brain back in order. Also, is there anything also? Oh, also, yeah, next time you have, years from now, if you're having open-heart surgery, you best not text me asking for support, because I got none to give you. We're going to continue reading The Salesman's Wife by John Lawrence. We are on the top of page 65. If you're reading along, we will read two pages together. He grunted as spasm after spasm of hot seed rushed into her trembling, sucking cunt. His eyes were glazed and his middle finger still probed like a knife in her burning rectal sheath. Stella received a bucking, heaving orgasm with eager, hungry delight. Her cuntal secretions gushed freely from the hot walls of her wet vagina. Her lewdly impaled asshole throbbed with sharp pain, and she was overwhelmed with wild, raging lust. Oh, oh, ah, ah! She mewled as gusts of wet, aching pleasure spread to every part of her body. Ah, ah! Gradually, Alan spent himself completely, and he squeezed the last bubbling drops of liquid into her raging pussy. Then he withdrew, easing both his deflating cock and his middle finger out of her proffering openings, and threw himself down on the soft rug on the floor. Stella, totally drained and satisfied, relaxed in utter delight on the couch. For a long while, there was an exhausted silence. Finally, Stella spoke. "I'm sure glad you came in for dinner tonight," she murmured lazily. "Me too," he said, smiling. Pamela Burns had returned for her second session with Dr. Carlsberg the following day, and after it was over, she had no doubt in her mind that she had made the right decision. Carlsberg had once again drugged the wine without Pamela's knowledge and then fucked her wildly after long, careful preparation. The young housewife had no idea that the euphoric ecstasy she felt each time she visited was a result of the spiked wine. She assumed that her extraordinary experiences were the direct result of the doctor's strange therapy and proof that she was able to break through her inhibitions with remarkable swiftness. She was eager and happy to continue with the sessions, even though she had to dip into the special bank account she and Alan was keeping aside for Christmas gifts. It was well worth the money, she thought, considering the progress she was making, and it was, after all, small payment to make if their marriage was to be saved. She had promised Carlsberg to return every day in the hopes that she would be cured by Monday when Alan returned from San Francisco. She stood in her bedroom, dressed in a tight-fitting blue sweater and skirt, and she wore much more makeup than usual. Since her visits had begun, she felt more liberated. Her body was no longer as stiff and rigid as it had been in the past, and she was conquentous and provocative for the first time in her life. She wanted to be particularly attractive today to show the doctor how much progress she was making, and especially since he had said that their third session would involve an unusual method of treatment. The adulterous young wife looked forward to her afternoon session and swirled around in front of the mirror, admiring her young, curvaceous body. "I hope he'll be pleased," she thought. "I want Dr. Carlsberg to know that I can trust him completely. He's such a brilliant man." Finally, she picked up her handbag containing a check for $70 and went downstairs to call a cab. Go suck a fat one.